Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. My name is Bill Meyer, and I am the presiding justice this afternoon. And on my right is Justice Dofano, and you all know, and on my left is Justice Walker. We'll be your panel for your cases this afternoon. And glad to see so many people here and in attendance. Welcome all to all of you, visitors and all. You'll call the case, please. We'll commence.
The court will now call Wanda Young, Tommy Young, Courtney Young, Ashley Young, and Justin Young versus Fulton Homes of Texas LP, Horizon Company LP, and Storm Air Incorporated. May it please the court, Mr. Thad is only to argue for the appellant. Mr. Yurtiago will argue for all athletes.
All right, counsel, are you ready?
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm Thad Spaulding along with Christy Wolin on behalf of the appellants, the Young family. This appeal presents two very different issues. The first has to do with bankruptcy disclosure. The second has to do with sanctions. I'll deal with the bankruptcy disclosure first. This is a case involving some mold damage in the Young's residence. At the time the Youngs discovered the mold damage, the water leaking in their house, they had an ongoing bankruptcy, Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and this was in 2010. At the time, Chapter 13 bankruptcy was ongoing. Eventually, that Chapter 13 bankruptcy was converted to Chapter 7, and that is the important distinction here. In the trial court, trial judge dismissed the parents, Tommy and Wanda Young's claims, and they were the ones that had declared bankruptcy, dismissed their claims for not disclosing their potential cause of action against the appellees in the bankruptcy proceeding. And what happened in the bankruptcy proceeding is started out as a Chapter 13. They discovered the mold damage in their house. In 2010, November of 2010, the case is converted to a Chapter 7 case. And then shortly after that, about a month after that, at a creditors meeting, Wanda Young is on the stand and discusses the mold damage to her home and discusses a claim and the fact that she has retained an attorney in that case to file a claim. Now, at that point, I think it was unclear what the extent of the claim was. She referenced a claim just against her homeowner's insurance company, but it was disclosed, at least orally, to the trustee at a creditor's meeting in the bankruptcy prior to the bankruptcy being dismissed and prior to this particular lawsuit being filed. Now, those facts give rise to a couple different issues as to why the dismissal of their claims in the trial court was incorrect. First is that this started out as a Chapter 13 case. One of the cases, the case that came out of this court, the Kilpatrick case, is a Chapter 13, is largely a Chapter 13 case. Under Chapter 13, when a debtor files Chapter 13 bankruptcy, all of his assets become property of the estate. Chapter 13 is unique in that once the Chapter 13 is initiated, then not only does it reach out and get the property that the debtor has at the time that the petition is filed, but it also adds to the estate any proceeds that are earned by the debtor while that bankruptcy is going on. And with the idea being the Chapter 13 is you want to try and work out some way to pay off those debts without completely liquidating everything, and you're largely paying them off from the proceeds of the property that the debtor has. Now, what commonly occurs is someone starts out at Chapter 13 with the grand ambition of paying off those debts or working out something, and they realize they can't do it. And so the statute of the bankruptcy code allows the debtor to, on his own, all he has to do is file a notice, and he can convert that bankruptcy to a Chapter 7. And Chapter 7 is just, you wipe the slate clean, but the downside of it is you liquidate everything you've got at a point certain. Now, the Chapter 7 is unique in that Chapter 7 only reaches out and makes property of the estate the property that the debtor has at the time that the bankruptcy is filed. It does not, it excludes property that is acquired during the course of the bankruptcy. And
7 or the 13?
I'm sorry?
Of the 7 or the 13?
Well, what happens is it goes along one track, and as soon as it's converted, even though it started out as a 13, it becomes a 7. So it the 7 reverts back.
I understand that, but I'm trying to understand what you're saying. Are you saying that you consider the property that existed only at the time the 7 was filed, or go back to the time the 13 was filed?
You go back to the time that the 13 was filed.
I want to make sure I understood what you were saying.
Right. So since this, the lawsuit that we're dealing with, the lawsuit against the appellees, was a post-petition asset. It in this case was converted to a Chapter 7 bank, and the bankruptcy was converted to Chapter 7. Then that asset never became a part of the estate. So the estate property began at the time what was initially a Chapter 13 bankruptcy was filed, then converted to Chapter 7, but it did not acquire any post-petition assets that the Youngs acquired, one of them being this lawsuit. And the reason that's important is because of the disclosure obligation. And as this court said in Kilpatrick, that there's a disclosure obligation, you've got to disclose your assets. Well, the purpose of disclosure is so that the trustee and the bankruptcy court has a handle on the assets of the estate. What assets are available to pay off these debts? In this case, since it converted to a Chapter 7, none of the post-petition assets became assets of the estate. And so anything that the Youngs acquired post-petition, this lawsuit being one of them, was not part of the bankruptcy estate and therefore did not need to be disclosed. And so because of that, the Youngs, it did not become part of the estate. The Youngs retained ownership of those claims and therefore had standing to file those claims when they did. And so the trial court was wrong when it dismissed those claims for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Now,
what would have happened if the Youngs had disclosed the claims and the trustee had no interest in them? I mean, is there a procedure for that?
Well, I think that's largely what happened is there was an affidavit filed. There were some objections lodged to it that were sustained, but there's an affidavit in the record from the trustee who discusses the fact that the claims were disclosed, or a claim was disclosed during the course of one of the creditors' meetings, and that she, she talked to the attorney
right.
and did some investigation
right,
on it.
Right, but I'm saying on the on the actual physical disclosure form.
Oh, if they had disclosed it on the initial schedule of
or
property?
They couldn't have on the initial one, obviously,
right.
but on a supplemental one or an amended one or whatever the procedure is for that.
Well, I think that I think then upon discharge, and I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, so I don't know physically how this happens, but my understanding is that the trustee upon discharge has the option of either prosecuting that case on his or her own behalf, or on behalf of the Youngs, and using those proceeds for purposes of paying off the debts, or they can abandon those claims, and you know, he or she may be of the opinion that they're not worth anything and aren't going to mess with them for purposes of paying off the debts, which actually leads to another interesting issue in the Chapter 13 context, and this is one of the cases that we cited in our brief, the Martin case out of Dallas, which notes a unique feature, assuming this had remained a Chapter 13 case. The Martin case notes that under Chapter 13, that a debtor remains in possession of the claim. Now, all proceeds of that claim are earmarked for the payment of any of the debts of the estate, but that in reality, the debtor retains ownership and possession of those claims, not to the proceeds, but to the claim itself. And so under those circumstances and under the Chapter 13 provisions, still actually has the standing to assert those claims. The bankruptcy estate would obviously have all rights to any proceeds, so any judgment that the Youngs got or any settlement that the Youngs obtained would necessarily have to go back to the Chapter 13 estate. But the Martin case indicates that, at least under Chapter 13, standing is not a foregone conclusion because of the unique nature of Chapter 13, which leaves, which makes the debtor a debtor in possession of the claim, although they don't have the rights to the proceeds. And the disclosure in this case, appellees take issue with the disclosure, but I think if you look at it, first of all, there wasn't a disclosure requirement because this was not property. This did not become property of the estate. But if there was a disclosure obligation, the Youngs disclosed that at the creditors' meeting, and they disclosed that there was a claim. Now they represented that it was just, as far as they knew, against the insurance company at that time. But according to the audio file and according to the affidavit, the trustee was given the attorney's information, and so then presumably was able to discuss and investigate that claim. And I think getting back to the purpose of disclosure, which this court recognized in Kilpatrick and which In Re Coastal Plains that the appellee cite acknowledge, the whole purpose is so that the trustee and the bankruptcy court can get their handle on these assets, what assets may or may not be available to pay off these debts. And even in this situation, the disclosures were sufficient to give the trustee and the bankruptcy court that ability, and so it should not have been fatal to the Youngs pursuing their claims.
I have another question. You know, procedurally, we don't encounter bankruptcies very frequently since we're a state court, but what's the effect of the subsequent bankruptcy and the fact that the stay order was lifted? And I have questions about whether a lack of standing is really the proper remedy, or if it's more of an abatement to cure the fact that this claim is still in a bankruptcy estate that no longer exists or has been closed, or I'm just not procedurally the posture. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, I'll try. I assume you're talking about the bankruptcy that was filed while this litigation was ongoing. Yeah.
Yes. Did that have any impact?
Well, they certainly disclosed the claim, and then that case came out of bankruptcy, and my understanding is, nobody's really questioned the fact that it came out and it didn't affect this claim. You know, Kilpatrick references filing a motion to reopen the bankruptcy. I mean, I think the subsequent bankruptcy certainly gave notice of it. I don't know if that's the right procedural vehicle, or if they were required, if the Youngs were required to go to bankruptcy court, file a motion to reopen their prior bankruptcy. But the subsequent bankruptcy certainly did create an estate, gave notice of all the assets of that estate, one of them being the claims of Tommy and Wanda. And then that bankruptcy case was ultimately discharged before the final judgment was entered in this case. I don't recall the Youngs arguing that had any practical impact on the standing issue. And for all practical purposes, their claims had already been dismissed well before that point. I think at that point, all that was left was the issue regarding attorney's fees. But it does raise an interesting question as to, I mean, it was ultimately disclosed in a formal schedule of property at some point. Whether it has retroactive effect, I don't know. Just about out of time. Well, I am out of time, and I'll reserve the rest of the argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Spaulding. Counsel.
Just a brief introduction. I'm David Urtiago. I represent Starnair, Inc. However, for the purposes of this oral argument, I'll be speaking on behalf of all of the appellees. May it please the court. There are two main issues presented. The first issue is the subject matter jurisdiction issue, and that issue is whether Wanda and Tommy Young had standing on May 19, 2011 to assert their claims. The second issue is whether or not the trial court had abused its discretion by making a finding that Justin Young, Courtney Young, and Ashley Young's DTPA claims were groundless, and then awarding Starnair, Inc. its attorney's fees incurred in connection defending against those claims. Starting with the first issue, which is the bankruptcy issue, which is what, you know, counsel ended with, I just want to...
The problem with your position that I see is that you are asserting that the bankruptcy estate maintained possession of a cause of action that the trustee had no interest in. So the trustee is never going to prosecute the claim. She had no interest in it. It was disclosed verbally. But yet your position is that the bankruptcy estate maintained possession of that cause of action. And that's, to me, the true problem with your position.
Yes. That particular issue was addressed specifically in the Kilpatrick decision, because in that case, the trustee also filed an affidavit saying that I give all my permission to, in that case, the plaintiff, to proceed. So in that case, you had the same thing, same affidavits. The court in that case simply held that that's not sufficient. You know, that in fact, what needs to happen is that you need to have standing at the time that the action is started and initiated. And that is ultimately an issue about whether or not those claims were disclosed in the property schedules, and that's it. It's a bright line test. That's all we have to do. Look at the schedules. Is it there? Is it not? If it's there, then the property was dispersed or revested into the debtor plaintiff upon the dismissal of the claim. If it's not, such as it was in this case, such as it was in Kilpatrick.
Do you know the trustee, if new property surfaces, can suggest that the debtor amend their schedules? You know they do that all the time.
Yes, Justice. However, in this case, what was represented to the trustee at the 341 trustee creditors hearing was that no such claim actually existed. Not only was it not disclosed, but what was disclosed, and this is a part of the record, you know, reviewing the audio tape, was that the only claims that Wanda Young had was against her insurance carrier, and when questioned by her bankruptcy attorney at the hearing, her response was, I only have a claim against the insurance carrier, that's it. You know, not verbatim, but that's essentially what she said, and that's a part of the record. So this is more than simply, you know, this is not something that is so easily cured by an affidavit that is filed after the initiation of the lawsuit by the trustee saying that, you know, I really don't have an interest in pursuing these claims. And by the way, there is an important issue, and this is why it is so important, I believe, that the Kilpatrick case does apply here, is because the rationale is still clearly applicable. Because Post-petition property remains the property of the estate when a Chapter 13 bankruptcy is converted to Chapter 7. That's generally the case. However, it still remains if there is a bad faith finding. The bankruptcy court or the trustee or other creditors can certainly move once they find out that there is property to be had, that this bankruptcy should not be converted to Chapter 7 and essentially allow the debtors to walk away with post-petition property not subject to their debts. In this case, what we have is a non-disclosure and, frankly, what appears to me to be an active concealment of these claims, and therefore no such argument of bad faith was even allowed to anybody. The rationale, and I just want to quote this from the Kilpatrick because it is directly on point with the argument. It's in the brief, which is, to quote Kilpatrick, the court stated that full disclosure is crucial to the integrity of bankruptcy proceedings. Thus, we hold that all non-disclosures of assets, whatever the reason, must be treated the same. Told otherwise would encourage a procedural in-run around the disclosure requirements. According to Kilpatrick, doesn't matter what bankruptcy we're talking about. Doesn't matter if it's Chapter 11, doesn't matter if Chapter 13, doesn't matter if it's Chapter 7. If there's a requirement to disclose, you must disclose. And absolutely there's a requirement to disclose here because it's undisputed that the claim arose during the pendency of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy estate. During the pendency, according to the Fifth Circuit, again, according to the Fifth Circuit and the Bankruptcy Code, there is a continuing duty to disclose your assets as they arise. In this case, it simply wasn't done, even though those claims were clearly a part of the bankruptcy estate. Kilpatrick clearly applies. There was no error. There was no subject matter jurisdiction because there's no standing. I wanted to hit upon the second issue, though, which is...
Can I ask you a question first, Mr. Yatigo, about what you're discussing at this point? The testimony at the 341A hearing disclosed knowledge of a set of facts that gave rise to a claim. Now, you identify that testimony as being directed upon the premise that the witness believed that it was an insurance claim, not a other, not any other kind of claim, and insurance being a matter of contract, looking at the coverage, not talking about negligence nor deceptive trade practice, but is it valid to compare what happened in this case with the Kilpatrick case when you're assuming that there could have been a claim for fraudulent concealment whenever there wasn't one made? In other words, it appears to me that your argument and your defense is based on the premise that what might have happened as opposed to what actually did happen.
The reason why I brought up the idea of a bad faith finding, even though clearly one was not made or even moved for it, was simply to elucidate or to emphasize the fact that the rationale behind the Kilpatrick opinion was to get was to foreclose the idea of a debtor plaintiff playing a game, essentially, you know, trying to game the system where they don't ever have to disclose property that is a part of their estate while still being able to maintain that property later on after the disclosure.
And I understand you ascribe bad faith to the Youngs because of those circumstances, but I'm only asking you to, if we apply the factual records of what actually occurred, then the jump to the premise of what might have happened is not what we're looking at here in terms of our ruling on the appeal today, because we're looking at what actually happened, not what could have happened. And there is no finding of bad faith, and I don't see that there was ever even developed in any of the record the question of what were the facts known at the time, what had happened, had there been already a leak of a water source that had caused a water pollution, and then the mold and all the other things that happened in terms of, were those the facts that were known at the time, and from what would flow from those facts in terms of the actual testimony? Here's a set of facts we know happened. I think that's an insurance claim, but it might also be a matter of negligence, deceptive trade practice, other things, because those aren't precluded by the mere fact you might have an insurance claim.
Yes, and in terms of what actually happened, none of that factual development that you're mentioning could possibly have happened because no one knew what these claims were. An insurance claim, they've lost the house at this point. And what they were trying to do, admission in the audio tape, was whether or not how to characterize any proceeds from an insurance claim into homestead, meaning protecting.
If your premise, what you just said, is correct, if no one actually knew about what all might happen, how can you hold them to the standard of they should have disclosed something that they didn't know?
Well, because they absolutely did know they have claims. They filed suit 7 days after their bankruptcy was discharged. The issue is that the trustee never knew, their creditors never knew, the bankruptcy court never knew the extent of these claims. That's why there could not never have been a finding of bad faith.
Well, I thought the record disclosed that the bankruptcy trustee in the Chapter 7 bankruptcy, Aria Holder, filed an affidavit that said she knew about the claims and discharged them.
The affidavit, the actual wording of the affidavit, one, it was filed much later after these events, but the actual wording simply said, I knew of the claims either at the time of the creditor's hearing or sometime after. Well, that's very important because if she didn't really know about the claims until May, you know, until after the discharge, that doesn't really help the plaintiffs slash appellants in this case. What the testimony needed to be, and in somewhat of an aside, because I still submit and contend that absolutely, the disclosure needs to be in the property schedules, not through an oral representation to the trustee. Nonetheless, what was actually put into that affidavit was insufficient to establish that, yes, she knew about the claim prior to the filing of this lawsuit and released the claim back to the appellant plaintiffs to proceed on their own merit or their own right. That's not in the record.
Thank you for your answer, sir.
Thank you. Just to hit upon the second issue, which is the issue of the shift under the fee shift under the DTPA, a number of issues were raised in the briefs, and they've been well briefed. However, there is one overarching argument that I do believe is dispositive of all the plaintiffs' complaints here on appeal, which is whether or not the trial judge considered all of the tendered evidence prior to making a decision. Now, both sides recognize that the Texas Supreme Court in Splotsetter v. Mayer, 1989 opinion, created the standard. Let me just quote from that here, which is whether the totality of the tendered evidence demonstrates an arguable basis in fact and law for the consumer's claim. Now, an important supplement to that came from this court in 1991 in the Elbor v. Sanderson case. In that case, the court explained that, unusually, this is a question of law under an abuse of discretion standard. Because it's a question of law, because it's for the trial judge to make, not the jury. However, it's under an abuse of discretion because the trial judge is allowed the discretion to make that decision. And in fact, we see from the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston, the Dallas Court of Appeals, and the Austin Court of Appeals have all held this holding, which is that when making a groundlessness finding, the trial court is permitted to resolve inconsistencies in testimony and judge credibility. So really the issue is, did the trial judge in this case consider all of the tendered evidence? If the trial judge considered all of the tendered evidence, then it's purely an abuse of discretion standard. So long as the record would support any sort of reasonable finding that it was groundless, it should still be upheld.
I have a question I'd like you to explain something for me. I'm confused. Section 348 of the Bankruptcy Code says that property acquired after filing Chapter 13 bankruptcy, but before conversion to a 7, is not property of the Chapter 7 estate. Can you explain that provision of 348 and how it's consistent with your position?
Yes, Your Honor. That's absolutely true. In fact, the appellants brought this up, which is their main argument is that the property was never a part of the estate because upon conversion, post-petition property is not a part of the Chapter 7 estate. The issue here, though, is that whether or not the property was ever a part of the bankruptcy estate. Because I'm applying Kilpatrick, and Kilpatrick says that as long as there's a duty to disclose and you fail to disclose,
I'm sorry. You've lost me.
Okay.
If it has to be part of the bankruptcy estate at the time of the filing of the 13, if it converts to a 7, then how was it always part of the estate if it wasn't part of the estate when the 13 was filed?
Because as conceded by the appellants, at the time that the claim actually arose, they are an active Chapter 13 bankruptcy. There had been no conversion yet. And so at the time that these claims arose, it was absolutely a part of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy estate because pursuant to the bankruptcy code, post-petition property is a part of that estate. And they had a duty pursuant to the bankruptcy code and the Fifth Circuit, they had a duty to disclose and amend their bankruptcy property schedules to show that. Now, the issue here is whether or not, because this property was ejected from the bankruptcy estate because of the conversion rather than mere dismissal, whether that needs to be treated fundamentally different than just a regular dismissal. Say it went from Chapter 11 to Chapter 13 or Chapter 13 to Chapter 11, which was the case in the Kilpatrick case because they had multiple bankruptcies in that case as well. And in the Kilpatrick case says, unequivocally, we understand this is a harsh ruling, we understand this is a bright line test, but it does not matter, it doesn't matter what bankruptcy we're talking about, under what chapter, if there's a duty to disclose and you didn't disclose, then the property remains the property of the bankruptcy estate upon dismissal. That's exactly what happened here. So either
just read 348, the way it's written, and if it says property acquired after filing the 13, is not part of the bankruptcy estate when it converts to a 7, then if it's acquired after filing the 13, well, it doesn't matter whether it's disclosed or not disclosed, or it's just not part of the estate. Isn't that what 348 says?
No, 348 says it's not a part of the estate upon conversion. I don't dispute that at all. What I'm trying to make the point, which is this court has made the policy decision in the Kilpatrick decision, it made the policy decision that said that upon, that if you did not disclose upon dismissal, it is no longer a part of, or it remains with the bankruptcy state. It's basically, it's the Kilpatrick opinion or it's not. Either Kilpatrick is still good law or it needs to be overruled.
Are there any cases following Kilpatrick?
Besides the Second Court of Appeals? Not that I know of. I do know that the Martin case that the appellants have cited to has attempted to distinguish Kilpatrick. However, there is maybe some issue about whether or not the Dallas Court of Appeals would simply overrule, you know, would simply take a different route. So yes, I would consider that there to be a split in the courts of appeals on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Gutiérrez. Counsel, have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Real briefly, I think Appellee's counsel is kind of flipping Kilpatrick to create a duty, to put the duty before property of the estate. And I think what Kilpatrick says, and Kilpatrick actually involved a situation where it was, at least with regard to two of the three bankruptcies that were filed in that case, it was pre-petition to those Chapter 13 bankruptcies. And so under Chapter 13, those reached out and grabbed all that property that existed at the time those petitions were filed, which included the assets at issue in Kilpatrick. And so under those circumstances, the way I read Kilpatrick is that under those circumstances, you've got an obligation to disclose those assets for the very reason that you've got to let everybody know what's out there, what's available to pay off these creditors. And if you don't do it, then it remains part of that estate and you don't get it back until it's disclosed and until the trustee does something with it. Obviously, as Justice Dofano, you keyed on, that's not the case once it's converted to Chapter 7. It's not part of the Chapter 7 estate. And one of the distinctions Appellee's counsel draws is that it starts out as this Chapter 13 estate and then it converts to this Chapter 7 estate. Well, the conversion to Chapter 7, that erases Chapter 13. You go back to point one and you treat this case like it's a Chapter 7. And that's at the debtor's option. And it's kind of this atomic option on the part of the debtor because it's pure liquidation now. And you're going to liquidate all these assets that you had at the genesis of the bankruptcy. But none of the cases, and the statute certainly makes it clear that you don't end up with this sort of hybrid bankruptcy proceeding that has different rules of disclosure at different points in time. I think.
Are you asking us to overrule Kilpatrick?
No, I don't think you need to overrule Kilpatrick. I don't think Kilpatrick applies in this situation.
It's distinguishable because it's your position that the 900 shares of the Press Corps stock existed at the initial filing of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy or the Chapter 11 bankruptcy?
I think that it I don't know that it existed at the time of the first bankruptcy, which was the 1990, I think, the Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But it certainly existed prior to the time that the two Chapter 13 bankruptcies were filed and ultimately dismissed. And the 900 shares were never disclosed in any of those bankruptcies. And in fact, in that case, the lawsuit was filed, and then 2 years later, after he'd been in a lawsuit for 2 years, he comes back and discloses those assets. So, no, I don't think you need to overrule Kilpatrick. I think Kilpatrick is distinguishable. If you know, for no other reason than it's a property that would have been part of those estates, and you don't have that situation here. I meant to do this at the very beginning. One of the cases we cite in our brief is In Re Harris out of the Fifth Circuit. It's not on all fours with this case, but it provides a good discussion of the distinction between Chapter 13 and Chapter 7 and converting from one to the other. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that case. It doesn't affect what we relied on it for, which is just how cases go from Chapter 13 to Chapter 7. But let me give you the site, the Westlaw site for that case. It is Harris versus Vigelon, V-I-E-G-E-L-A-H-N, and it is 2015 WL234087. And actually what that case, I think it kind of proves the point even more. Harris involved a situation with proceeds that had been paid to the trustee pre-conversion. And the Fifth Circuit said, well, since you had paid those fees, since those proceeds had become to the possession of the trustee pre-conversion, we're going to go ahead and let that Chapter 13 trustee pay all those fees out to your creditors, even though you've now converted it to a Chapter 7. And the Fifth Circuit said, yeah, that's okay. And the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday said, no, that's not right. Once the case is converted to Chapter 7, all that has to come back. And it goes a little bit further. It talks about whether the Chapter 13 trustee even has authority to do anything at that point, but it says that money's got to come back to the debtor once, if it's post-petition conversion to Chapter 7, it's got to go back to him. And
before you leave, sir, I know your time's out, but I want to ask you one thing.
Sure.
What relief do you seek from this court as to the parties, all the parties defended?
It's a little, I understand.
It's
a little staggered.
It'll take you a little while to answer, but I'd like to understand exactly what you would like in your prayer for relief to this court.
Right. And to be clear, we'd like the court to reverse the dismissal of the claims of Tommy and Wanda Young. And those were the two parents. Those were the claims that were dismissed because of the bankruptcy issue. With regard to their three children obviously were not part of the bankruptcy. They had their claims dismissed on no evidence motion for summary judgment. We don't challenge the ruling on no evidence motion for summary judgment, but we think that the court should reverse the sanctions judgment or the attorney's fees judgment against them under the DTPA, reverse that and reverse the attorney's fees award in order that the Starn Air, one of the appellees who got the attorney, the only one that got the attorney's fees, that they take nothing on that on their DTPA groundless claim.
So if your relief were granted, Wanda and Tommy Young would still have a cause of action against all of the defendants, but there would be no involvement of the children as parties, and the judgment against them for attorney's fees would be reversed.
That's correct.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Thank you both for your argument and your briefs. And your case is submitted.